are listening to The Lonely TARDIS Season 2, Episode 12, Your Journey Through Time Lords and Space, where we take you on a wonderful weekly adventure through the worlds of Gallifrey, Earth, and anywhere else the Doctor takes us. I'm Dolly Domofsky, one of your hopefully wonderful hosts. Joining me as usual, Stephen Strum.
And like a wise man named Sean Norton once said, it wouldn't be The Lonely TARDIS if we just didn't have every sound issue we possibly could going on at the same time.
Exactly, exactly. Sean is unfortunately unable to be with us this week. He is in Iceland, maybe dealing with some of the ice warriors over there. Who knows? But in his stead, we have Marcus Beer, Mr. Annoyed Gamer. Thank you, Marcus, for joining us this week.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, most definitely. I noticed Marcus tweeting over the weekend about Doctor Who, and we chatted a little bit online, and I knew right away he had to be on the show. He seems to be a total super fan. And so we're actually, before we get into this week's episode, I want to hear a little bit about your experience with Doctor Who, because Marcus, you've had quite a bit of experience. Some of the things you were telling us in the pre-show.
Well, I mean, for a start, obviously I'm a Brit, so I grew up with Doctor Who. I watched my first episode when I was 4, which was 38 years ago. And I mean, that was around the start of the Tom Baker era.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Tom Baker was my first Doctor, and obviously you never forget who your first Doctor is. So yeah, I mean, I followed the show all the way through. You know, it's ups and it's downs. I mean, there's been some low points. Paul McGann's, you know, Paul McGann would have been a great Doctor. Unfortunately, he was in that horrible Fox crossover.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, I followed the show all the way through, and I find it, it's a total pain in the ass for me that, being from Wales, you know, big fan of Doctor Who, I moved to the States in 1999, and then in 2005, they reboot Doctor Who, and where they film it, in my home, my home patch. So, I've been at the show for so long. I've been to the Doctor Who exhibition and the Doctor Who experience. I had the great fortune to meet Matt Smith, Karen Gillan, Arthur Darvill and Stephen Moffat at Comic-Con last year at a BBC America thing. I've just come back actually from the UK where, you know, I spent some time with my family and came back after going to the shop at the Doctor Who experience again and loading up on goodies.
Tell me, what's the Doctor Who experience like? What exactly is it?
This is the second one. There's first of all the Doctor Who exhibition, mm-hmm. which was basically in Cardiff, obviously where they filmed Doctor Who. And that was a walk around, almost like museum, that was really cool. I mean, they'd have props. They had, you know, all sorts of costumes and everything from all the Doctors. So just some really great stuff you could see in action. I mean, you could see Davros addressing the Daleks. You could see the Cybermen. They had the Weeping Angels, obviously. And then, you know, it had probably the greatest Doctor Who shop you could ever find outside of, you know, 15 Doctor Who conventions piled into one. I mean, they had some really good stuff. I've got a sterling silver Dalek keychain, and I think it's a Cyberman bottle opener that you can't get in this country. But that's just a few of the swath of Doctor Who swag I've accumulated over the years. And then basically, they went and, you know, they took this exhibition on the road, took it to Earl's Court for a while in London, while they were building a new permanent home in Cardiff for the Doctor Who experience, mm-hmm. which is a full-on guided tour. Now, unfortunately, I never got to go in and see that when I was home because I didn't realize that you basically have to book tickets in advance.
Mm.
They give you a set time since it's a guided tour. So I got in through the front door. I got to see a lot of stuff they had in the reception area, which was really cool. I mean, they had Bessie there from John Pertwee's era,
mm-hmm.
the yellow Whomobile, if you will. They had a large red Lego Dalek, and of course the shop upstairs where, again, I bought some really cool stuff, including a very cool promo poster for the K-9 character. That's basically almost like it's Fallout-esque, you know.
If mm-hmm, you're from, mm-hmm.
Fallout games. It's that sort of like, you know, buy this dog, it's awesome, but it's that sort of promo poster. So it's spray painted onto wood, so that is ready to go up in my games room if I can find some space.
So you have I'm assuming you probably have shelves and shelves of just cool swag you've accumulated over the years.
I mean, I've got everything from vintage Tom Baker doll to mm-hmm. collectible to original Cybermen.
Oh wow.
I've got I've got a radio controlled Davros that's like
what is that like?
Well, it's basically it's just a big radio controlled Davros. I mean, I've got one of those, a black Dalek as well. And I mean, this is stuff again I picked up in the UK, you know, over the last like 6-7 years going back for Christmas, because again, you can't get this stuff. So it's basically all right, I'm going to get this, rip out the packaging, wrap it up in my clothes in my suitcase, and bring it home. So yeah, I mean, the Davros is awesome. Actually, it scares the crap out of my cats. So I like Doctor Who. I have cats, but I also have a wife as well. I'm not creepy living on his own guy surrounded by cats and Davros remote control toys.
A big giant poster of Davros in your bedroom.
Yeah, no.
No, there won't be that. Have you played any of the Doctor Who games? Either the adventure games or I think there was a really bad Wii game.
There's the Eternity Clock, too.
Eternity Clock, oh yeah, yeah.
My very first one-star review on the YouTube.
Yeah, I got asked. I've played all the games. I mean, you know, that's what I do. My job is to review video games for a living, so it's fun. But then I get sent the Doctor Who stuff, and I just get so rampantly depressed by the quality of it. That, you know, it's enough to, you know, put me off games for life. I mean, some of the stuff is so bad, and it's really, really strange because, I mean, Doctor Who, yeah, it's tough to turn into a video game, but I think I've hit on the perfect formula for a Doctor Who game, and basically make it a Lego game.
Oh, you know, that would be very cool.
Yeah, Lego Doctor Who puzzle solving, 11 different doctors, all those different enemies. The guys at Traveler's Tales have done some amazing stuff, and I think that would be perfect. So, I mean, I've actually pitched it to some friends at BBC Worldwide a couple of times, and they're like, well, we don't know. So maybe somebody needs to get a petition going. So I think it would be a great game that could be done by, again, a British team who would get Doctor Who.
Definitely. Have you, have you seen the minifigs, obviously, the Doctor Who minifigs, and those look wonderful as kind of tiny plastic characters. I can totally imagine an entire game based around that. So you wouldn't do like a Telltale adventure game?
That, for the record, is what I suggested on, I think, like 2 weeks ago. I thought maybe Telltale picking up the franchise and doing a Walking Dead on it might be interesting.
I could see both, to be honest with you. I mean, I could see the adventure game be doing very well. I would think that given, I mean, and you've got to remember there's a strange dichotomy between Doctor Who America and Doctor Who in the UK, where in the UK it is pretty much a kid's show. And you know, I mean, there are people who've grown up watching it like myself that, you know, who do watch it, but it's predominantly a kids show, and that's what it's known for in the UK. Whereas here in the US, it's known predominantly as a sci-fi show. So, I mean, when it comes to what would sell more and what would reach a wider audience, I think fiscally it would make sense for them to do perhaps a Lego game and then also work on a, you know, Walking Dead episodic game that would perhaps not have much risk and then would also appeal more to the older sci-fi fan. But I know I'd certainly buy both.
No, most definitely. As long as they can do some good things with licenses. We've seen some licensed games this year, and one that you're actually playing right now, Marcus. I've been following your tweets that licenses have not done well this year, let's just say. Hopefully, I'd love to see a Doctor Who surprise announcement at E3 this year. That would completely make my... Forget next gen. I want a Lego Doctor Who.
Just think how cool the collector's edition would be.
Oh my god, yeah.
Man, so I grew up playing with Legos quite a lot, and I've never played a Traveler's Tales Lego game. But man, if this just this very idea of a Doctor Who Lego game makes me kind of want to go play one of the other Traveler's Tales games and just kind of imagine what it would be like now all of a sudden.
Go and experience one of them, because, I mean, even if you look at, say, the Lego Star Wars game that they did, which was the original trilogy, that was actually really good, and a great way to show how you can embrace the universe and work with existing stuff. Some of the stuff has been repetitive since. I mean, they've done the two Batman games. Lord of the Rings was a little bit of a yawn for me. I really do think, especially as you can't have a game where the Doctor beats the crap out of everybody or shoots weapons, this is where that would be perfect.
Yeah, he pulls out the sonic screwdriver and suddenly all the bricks start flying into place and forms up some kind of pathway or something. I mean, I'm envisioning this in my head, and it actually does sound incredibly cool. I'd never even thought of this, and that I can't believe it seems so simple now.
I'm already putting a design doc together, guys. So continue talking, and I'll include your names on the...
Yeah, don't forget, of course, it is, you know, my idea, copyright me forever. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Sometimes the simplest things, everybody's like, oh, my God, that is so simple. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, I'd love to, like I said, Warner Brothers own Traveller's Tales now, so we'll see what happens.
Excellent, excellent. Well, that's you certainly bring a good amount of knowledge of Doctor Who to the show, so I'm definitely glad to have you on for that. But I'm also interested to see or to hear what you've kind of felt of the season thus far. Right before we get into to Hyde, what have you felt about Clara as a new sidekick or as a new companion? I'm sorry.
She's interesting. Mm-hmm. She's definitely interesting. I do like one who's an enigma, and the fact that this is the third time we've seen her in the last 12 months, mm-hmm. you know, the third iteration of Oswin or whatever she's going to turn out to be. That mm-hmm. is really, really interesting. I think she's certainly not as bad as some of the companions in, you know, since the reboot started. I've never been a Rose fan. Martha.
Thank God. Thank God.
Martha drove me to the edge of turning off my TV. So yeah, I mean, she's cool. I mean, she, you know, as long as it doesn't devolve into that mushy, doe-eyed, unrequited love for the Doctor that people seem to have this incredible, you know, attachment to. I mean, for me, Donna Noble has been the best companion several years.
Definitely.
Because Donna is not interested in the Doctor, and she may not be his equal intellectually, but she's his equal in every other way, and she has got more of a grounded soul and is not afraid to talk about it, compared to some of the others who will just sit there going, the Doctor, and I just want to slap him or chuck him out the TARDIS front door in the middle of space.
Martha was the ultimate in that respect. Oh.
She was a pain in the ass. She really
you are going to fit on this show very well, this episode. Giving propers to Donna is definitely something that I can get behind.
I think that's a requirement now, I think.
Random anecdote. I live in Los Angeles, and obviously, yeah, you know, you do see celebs and stuff. About 2 weeks after the Donna Noble season finale, where the Doctor had obviously, you know, done his thing to save her, I am with my wife shopping at the Beverly Center, and we are walking through H&M, and 3 feet in front of me, walking towards me, is Catherine Tate.
Oh.
And for the, I don't get starstruck. Uh-huh. I mean, I wasn't even starstruck last year, like I said, at Comic-Con. But having just gone through that emotional ending, I'm just looking at her and I'm like, oh. And my wife has, because she sees me gawping. Catherine Day sees me gawping. She's like, hi, how are you? And my wife literally has said, you know, he's a big fan and blah, blah, blah. And she was so sweet. She was talking about, you know, when she found out where I was from, she was talking about filming in Swansea and a lot of other things. So she was really nice, but I don't think she expected to go halfway around the world on vacation. And literally she'd landed that afternoon and was fighting jet lag. And the first thing she sees is this 6'2", 200-pound, 38-year-old guy gawking at her going, Donna Noble.
Have you watched the American version of The Office with her as one of the characters recently?
I haven't. I can't stand The Office.
Yeah, I don't think anybody can anymore. She has been fantastic on this. She has been the only watchable part of the show, and they use her just enough as an actor that makes her tolerable without obviously going into too many weird Office tropes, but she's actually been pretty good on the series.
I'd have to see the rest of the show.
Yeah.
And the rest of the episode, and yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a cast, you want to walk.
Yeah, it must just be a YouTube clip show, yeah.
Yeah, the YouTube clip show. Thank you very much.
Well, excellent. Well, definitely Donna is, as Steven said, that we're huge fans of Donna on the show, and we really hope that Clara lives up to it. She just certainly seems to have... There's something about her as an enigma that it seems to be pretty intriguing. So, any other thoughts about the season up until this point?
Oh, Craigie. Well, I mean, I thought it was a good kickoff with the Wi-Fi episode. Mm-hmm. I thought it was pretty clever. And I think the overall, I mean, we're four episodes in now. I think the only downer episode or just iffy episode for me was two, the Rings of
Akhaten.
Yeah, that one. That one to me was just like it was just so heavy on the sap. And mm-hmm. I mean, I think that, you know, you can put that into Doctor Who, but you can't have it as a recurring theme, and you can't have it that saccharine. I mean, you know, the whole having to sing and it was a little much for me. I mean, it was a waste of a potential episode, you know, episode for me. But yeah, I thought, you know, they bounced back with the submarine episode. Great way to reintroduce the Ice Warriors, who are, you know, now scarier than ever. I mean, it worked. Somebody I was talking to actually said that it reminded them of the Christopher Eccleston episode Dalek, which, you know, is also which I can understand, but it also had this, you know, alien-esque vibe mm-hmm, about it, mm-hmm. you know, being on the submarine. So yeah, I think it's bounced back, and I think, you know, the trailer for the next one looks really good. And having just seen the Radio Times poster for the season finale,
yes.
mm-hmm. That's going to be another interesting one.
Most definitely, most definitely. I was just, and we'll get into the some of that stuff towards the end of the episode here. But that's good to know, because I think I'm on that same page. I know Steven's on the same page. Every week we rate our thoughts about the episode. We rate the episode, and we've kind of been up and down. I think for the reason that the reasons that kind of you stated there, things tend to get a little hokey sometimes, or a little overly sappy, and other times they don't seem to be utilizing certain themes enough. So maybe we'll find out what happened this week in the episode titled Hyde, which aired just this past Saturday. Let me quickly go over the little recap. If you gentlemen notice that I miss anything, feel free to jump in, because I usually do. So this week's episode takes place in 1974 with Professor Alec Palmer and his assistant Emma Grayling, collecting photographic evidence of a ghost known as the Witch of the Well in the Caliburn Mansion. So they're using Emma as kind of the psychic channel to call the ghost to them, who happens to show up but the Doctor and Clara. Knock on the door, they appear, and I love the line that they throw down, that when Emma says, "Who are you?" And Clara says, "We're the Ghostbusters." And so Doctor and Claire show up. They investigate the house. Doctor actually turns out to be a huge fan of the professor's work. They manage to come to the conclusion that the ghost is somebody who is trapped in time, I guess you could say. Was it a pocket dimension is the – or pocket universe terminology they used? Pocket dimension? Yep, and so the Doctor devises a plan to transport himself into this pocket dimension using some type of harness that he creates, and gets a blue crystal. Steven, what was the name of that crystal? I couldn't quite remember the name of it.
I don't know that the crystal has a name, but it is the same crystal that showed up in the John Pertwee stories. I forget which the Green Death. He found it on Metabilis 3, and then it showed up again in Planet of the Spiders, according to Wikipedia, anyway.
So he mounts this crystal on a headpiece, sort of a crown type of thing that, that Emma has to wear, and amplifies her power. She opens a door to this pocket dimension. Doctor hops in, tries to find the kind of trapped time traveler, which this ends up being. Also comes to find that there is a sort of boogeyman monster that is actually chasing her, and that's why she's been trapped. He escapes, realizes that the whole reason that the monster is chasing is because he's in love with his female counterpart, which is trapped in our time. And so he goes back in, rescues the monster, comes back out, and the show is over, for better or worse. In a nutshell, that was it. So I spoke to Sean a little bit about this, and I'm just going to read Sean's thoughts, because and that I'm going to jump right down Sean's throat as to why he's wrong.
I was about to say, we might as well get the incorrect stuff out of the way right now.
Yes, exactly. So Sean says that he felt that it was a really good episode, had a fun narrative, but he actually felt that the last 5 to 10 minutes undid it. And he says it's actually a reminder that Doctor Who lately relies too much on romance to the point where it goes over the top to outdo itself, to try to constantly top the romantic themes of the previous episodes. And he said it got way too convoluted at the end, but he really liked it otherwise. So while I do agree that love, that romantic aspect was maybe a little bit overdone, I don't think it... I don't think it killed the show for, you know, I don't think it did anything to the episode for me and a negative aspect. Marcus, how did you feel about this episode this week? Was there too much romance, or what do you think it was just right? Or was there other thoughts that you had?
Well, let me get the good stuff out of the way first. Yeah. First of all, I mean, it did strike me as a throwback to what I consider, mm-hmm. you know, old school Doctor Who's best period, which was the gothic era of the Tom Baker's run, where, you know, that was actually some of my favorite episodes. The some of those episodes were just absolutely outstanding, mm-hmm. and for me, you know, it formed my tastes in horror. Because, you know, in Britain we have a phrase about hiding behind the sofa when you watch Doctor Who. And I spent a couple of years behind the sofa every time Doctor Who was on when they were in that sort of like gothic horror period. And I think they did that very, very well. I did like you talked about the crystal from Metabolist 3. There were another couple of really good mentions that were quite interesting. Heart of the TARDIS mm-hmm. was mentioned. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you hear the cloister bell.
Yes.
Always love a good cloister bell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cloister bell can always, you know, it's like, oh, okay, crap's about to get real. So, yes, there was some very, very good stuff there. I mean, the tension was up. They had a very good cast. Doug Gray Scott, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it's interesting to think that, you know, 10 years ago he was going, or even longer than that, he was Wolverine.
Yeah.
You know, but for a back injury, he could be Hugh Jackman now. But I think, you know, they were really good, you know, supporting cast. And I think I wouldn't be surprised to see them kind of spun off as sort of like these ghost hunters, because they've done that with the Sarah Jane Adventures and obviously Torchwood. Mm-hmm. And I think those two would actually work very well together. I think there were a lot of positives. It was one of the best episodes out of the run, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But yes, the recurring desire for romance. I mean, we all, you know, we could figure out right away that the, psychic had this love for this guy, mm-hmm. and this guy was still damaged after World War II, and you know, he's scared to show his love, and all right, that's one love story. And then of course we've got, oh well, let's not just do one love story, let's do another love story, let's have the monster you know, it's a love story, so okay. And oh, let's have a family throw in as well, because the, you know, the woman you rescue is your great 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 granddaughter. And then everybody can go off and live happily ever after. And that, to me, is a little bit, it's a little bit much, and it could bring it down. Other high points for me, and I think this will be my last one, is mm-hmm. just how Clara's relationship with the TARDIS is evolving. And I think that with the Heart of the TARDIS next week, that's going to be a really interesting episode, because we've had some ups and, downs. I mean, the TARDIS mm-hmm. refusing to translate and let her in some episodes, and then, you know, obviously picking when the TARDIS wanted to talk to Clara, it was a case of using a picture of herself. That was actually really quite cool. I mean, it's almost like, you know, a cat fight. So I think, you know, I liked a lot of the touches there, and like I said, I liked a lot of the things that they brought back from classic Who that were just thrown in there to, you know, keep us happy.
You mentioned the cloister bell. What I kind of found interesting was how Clara is drawn to the TARDIS and the cloister bell. It seems like every week there's definitely more of a love-hate relationship between Clara and the TARDIS than there is Clara and the Doctor. And in this case, this week, Clara actually manages to, she hears the cloister bell, runs up to the TARDIS, and it's obviously locked. She's trying to get in. Pleads with it, but then the TARDIS takes they call it a voice interface, a holographic image of Clara. It's Clara's form. And I just kind of found that such a really interesting kind of play together of what Clara could potentially end up becoming. Because you obviously this is a brand new TARDIS, and even the Doctor of this episode mentions something about to the effect of that he's still trying to figure out some of the things with the new TARDIS. Where did you know? Where do they put the umbrella? Right, there was that whole scene of where did I put the umbrella? Oh, it should be over there. Wait, no, that was the old TARDIS. This is the new TARDIS. So there's definitely this interesting relationship forming between Clara and the TARDIS, I think.
Yeah. Can I actually say also like the TARDIS redesign?
Yes.
I mean, I did like the David Tennant era mm-hmm. TARDIS. And then when they gutted it at the end of his run, because again, a little anecdote. Turns out a kid I was in youth theater with when I was a teenager, he grew up to become the production designer for Russell T. Davis. Huh. And nice. He actually designed the interior of the TARDIS on the Russell T. Davis run. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of the bad guys redesigned the Cybermen, did the sonic screwdrivers. He was like, yeah, he's kind of brilliant. But yeah, I would have hoped that when they gutted the TARDIS from Matt Smith's run, they would have given it a significantly different, mm-hmm. you know, just a different feel. Because, I mean, they went to town, and you don't normally see the TARDIS getting kicked the crap out of like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to go in and do it, don't make it slightly different. And just, you know, jazz it up a little. And this one, again, this one seems like a nod back in time to, like I said, the Baker, Pertwee mm-hmm. era. Except for when they had the wood finished TARDIS, which was really kind of that looked like one of the rooms from the Playboy Mansion.
To me, this new TARDIS, and I don't think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, it reminds me a lot of the sort of prototype TARDIS we saw in The Lodger. I don't know if that's maybe on this show we have a tendency to kind of fall back in time and look at very obscure things that the production team probably doesn't remember. And try to say to ourselves, hey, this is probably going to be a callback to that, when it's probably not, because we're probably the only people that notice that kind of stuff. So
mm-hmm.
I don't want to say it is actually a direct callback to The Lodger, but that is what it looks like a lot to me. It's very dark and kind of foreboding almost.
Well,
are you talking about the ship that was on top of the building?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I don't think that was a TARDIS.
Oh, I thought it was a prototype. Maybe I am wrong. I thought he said at the end that it was somebody trying to build a TARDIS.
Yeah, I think it more like a knockoff, perhaps. I mean, yeah. And this sort of tapped into the silence because it came back in, you know, later on the silence. But I mean, I think it's more the equivalent of, you know, the Chinatown Rolex.
Okay.
You know, that you'd get. I don't think that was a prototype. I mean, I may be wrong, but
When I say prototype, I mean like somebody else was building a prototype of their version of the TARDIS. Like somebody was trying to reverse engineer their own early version of the TARDIS, and that was a mistake or like some kind of thrown away version of it.
Interesting. You bring up both. You kind of bring up the throwback aspect of the TARDIS design during those little interludes between the commercial breaks. On BBC America, I believe it was actually this week they talked about the TARDIS design and how it was actually more of a throwback to the William Hartnell days, where it was very machine-like and meant to be more mechanical and more of a tool rather than a home. So I kind of found that pretty cool. I did like the throwback to the Hartnell days, and there seemed to be a lot of that. One of the themes that we've picked up on this season is that there's a lot of throwbacks to pre-Russell T. Davies Doctor Who. So like everything back to Hartnell and Baker and Pertwee and so forth. So they're bringing some of those aspects into this season. And I think by redesigning the TARDIS, that could be one of them.
Well, I think, you know, you look at Matt Smith's costume. I mean, it is very much, you know, Hartnell-esque almost. Mm-hmm. With, you know, shades of the others. I mean, yes, he's made it his own, and the color scheme is more modern for, you know, our modern times. But it does make sense. I mean, you know, we are in the 50th year to really sort of like bring things almost full circle, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I love when they do these nods. I mean, that was one of the things that really irked me for the first season or so. They seemed very reluctant. I mean, apart, you know, we saw Dalek and we started to see things, you know, Cybermen getting rebooted, but it seemed like they were almost, I mean, what else was it? The Autons were nesting consciousness from the first episode.
Yep.
But it was just one of those things that they still seemed reluctant to really embrace the history of what almost, went on.
Almost as if they were embarrassed of
yes.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. And I mean, the fact that, I mean, Russell T. Davis, you know, he writes some really good stuff and he helped, you know, he probably penned my favorite David Tennant episode in The Waters of Mars. But I mean, you know, again, it was one of those things that they was almost like, and I can understand the remit from the BBC being, oh, well, we have to reinvent this. We have to do this because we don't want people thinking it's something their granddad watched and blah, blah, blah. And the fact that they're now comfortable enough to move away from that, and BBC America are also doing The Doctors Revisited, which is all, you know, Doctor 101. I mean, personally, I would love for BBC America every Saturday morning from 8 until noon, put a whole Doctor Who, two Doctor Who stories on back to back, starting with Hartnell, then Troughton, then Pertwee, then Baker, then Davison, then Baker, then McCoy, and then just literally go through every single one.
That would just be amazing, absolutely.
Which is what they did, which BBC America actually did before Doctor Who came back. Doctor Who was on every Saturday morning. They'd actually run that stuff through. And I mean, you know, they want to get their DVD business or their Blu-ray business or whatever on demand, you know, selling. You've got to do stuff like this.
And you can only get so many of the episodes through Netflix. They don't have nearly enough on there.
No, they don't. They don't. That's why I have the, you know, a slew of DVDs every time they buy them.
The nice thing about it is they've been releasing them quite often now.
Yeah, and I do like some of the things they've done for where you've actually lost some of the they've lost a couple of the episodes of a story arc, and they basically do them in the graphic comic and have the audio, because they managed to keep almost the audio of almost all the episodes, which is great. So yeah, I do like what they do, and I just wish that they'd really, you know, buck it up a little bit on this.
Oh, but BBC America needs all that space for all their 37 cooking shows, you know, so.
don't forget. Oh, I mean, like I said, don't get me started. I mean, you know, the fact that we never got Doctor Who Confidential.
Yes.
And now that obviously the BBC's had to cut that because of the Tory government wanting to gut the BBC from inside once again. So, yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff that could have been done. I mean, even in the US, we on the Blu-rays, we got a cut down Confidential. Which was, kind of sucked, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But I think, look, BBC America are doing a good job. There is a lot more good stuff on BBC, on British television, that you don't get to see over here. That is more than Top Gear, Gordon Ramsay, Doctor Who, and Orphan Black.
The Top Gear spin-offs, you know. Yeah.
I mean, again, some of them are great, but I mean, there's a lot. I mean, Broadchurch is a great series that the BBC could snag and bring over. That's David Tennant's new series. And it's it's a detective series, but again, and I'm sorry, I'm dragging us away from Doctor.
That's
Who.
Right.
Back to Doctor Who.
Tennant's actually in the Politician's Husband as well. That's something that's a drama that's coming up. I'm a huge Tennant fan. Tennant, even though I began with Netflix with Eccleston, but I think Tennant was my doctor. I think Tennant's a lot of people's doctor just because of the return. So anytime David Tennant is anything, I tend to gravitate towards it, but
no, he's an excellent doctor, and he really helped take it mainstream. And you know, I mean, it did help that, you know, BBC America in particular managed to get behind it, and they pulled, because don't forget that first season was on Sci-Fi.
Yes,
and it was slaughtered on Sci-Fi. I mean, it was just, you know, Sci-Fi Channel's a joke and has been for several years, and the fact that as soon as BBC America got it back and started promoting it, the figures went up. And like I said, one of my favorite episodes, probably my second favorite of all time is The Waters of Mars, which is where I would love to have seen, you know, a couple of more episodes of David Tennant going in that direction of the Doctor on the edge before we get to the end of time, part one and two. If we'd have had two more specials like that, I think it would have been perfect.
Totally agree. Well, I also really enjoyed this episode. I thought there were a lot of great detail. I'm very much a detail-oriented, not always plot-oriented, more of kind of set production and things like that. One of the things that I really enjoyed in this episode was the wonderful use of lighting as a narrative element. Whenever there was like lightning and lots of flashes of lightning, it was used to give you kind of hints at things that were taking place without actually without actually seeing anything. So that, whether it was a flash of a camera bulb or lightning in the background when the Crooked Man, I think, is actually what the name that they used for the monster was.
That's a good name.
Yeah, exactly. I thought that was great. Candles, whenever there were kind of secret or one-on-one conversations, candles were popping up. The red lighting used in the photography processing area where the... I thought this was actually really interesting. When the professor is kind of talking about his story as a decorated war hero who killing was his profession before he decided that, hey, that's not what he wants to do. So he's telling this story of somewhat of a personal redemption about killing and death and murder and ghosts amidst this bright red, almost blood-like lighting background. I thought that was actually really well, whether it was intentional or not, I'm not sure. And then just that final scene, those final scenes of the doctor running through the fog with the sunlight kind of skipping through the mist there. I thought that was, that basically right down to Blair Witch levels of horror with the Crooked Man hopping, between trees and so forth. So, I think lighting wise, they did an absolutely wonderful job with this episode and the set design. I love the mansion, I think it was Caliburn Mansion that they set the location at, but just not a not any kind of place where they had to kind of do a lot of traversing over a giant city or anything. I love these episodes where there are more confined areas and you're really forced to focus on the characters and the plot that you're given, so you don't have to worry about what else is taking place in the city that nobody can notice, this type of thing. So that was really well done, and it's always a positive. And I'm a huge fan of the more horror based, I guess, the darker Doctor Who episodes. And we see them pop up time and time, maybe once or twice a season if we're lucky. I think there was what was the one last season? I think it was in October. It was one of the one off, or not October? It was last year sometime. It was one of those kind of the monster of the week type of thing, but there was one that was actually really well done last season as well that Moffat was a part of. But and the one I'm also very detail oriented, so I tend to pick up some inconsistencies and details, and I found it really interesting that the doctor borrows a camera to go take photographs at different stages in the Earth's development. So he goes back to the beginning of time of planet Earth to the end. He's dressed in this safety suit, yet he borrows a film camera, which would surely melt, at the end of days.
Well, actually, no, it wouldn't melt because, yeah, I mean, he wears the safety suit, which he also wore in Waters of Mars.
Yeah.
But if you look, if you go back to, I think, even the end of the first series of Doctor Who with Christopher Eccleston, mm-hmm. Yeah, the TARDIS does have a force field.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you're right, actually. That is a good point.
The force field does extend beyond, uh-huh. So I mean, it's not inconceivable that he would have protected.
I was actually thinking about that as the episode aired. So yeah, suck it, Dally.
Yeah, you guys have completely you have changed my minds on that one. Well, I'm gonna scratch it off my list of things that I thought were interesting. Although the conversation that Clara has with the doctor at that moment, she says, "Where do we just go?" She said, "Oh, it's the beginning of humanity and the end of humanity." And she says, why would you do that? He says, well, I have a time machine. I can do that. She says, we're all just ghosts to you, though. You're looking for this ghost, but we really are all just ghosts to you. You've seen after we've been alive. We've all passed away. We're all buried in the ground. And so I thought that was kind of another interesting little tidbit that Clara is constantly trying to figure out the doctor, even though the doctor's trying to figure her out. I think she's kind of onto this time travel isn't really all it's cracked up to be type of thing. And I'm really kind of enjoying that about her character. I haven't been sold yet on her character, but I'm liking the questions that she's asking.
Yeah. If she turns out to be River Song's daughter, I would be very pissed.
River Song's daughter, but not the doctor's daughter.
No. Because the doctor has a daughter that we already know.
Yes.
Around the universe.
And Jenny.
Heard of it again. Yeah.
That was a couple weeks ago. We theorized that Clara might be Jenny's daughter or related to Jenny in some way.
That will be interesting. She's only got one heart as far as we know. Mm-hmm. But Dali, I'll go back to your point on the intimacy of mm-hmm. this show mm-hmm. and the intimate feel of this episode. And that's what I liked about last week's as well, the submarine mm-hmm. one. Doctor Who works best when it's in enclosed spaces. Doctor Who works best when there's not a character, a galaxy of people. And a lot of the time when it does try to bring in everybody, it gets more than a little muddled.
Yes, definitely.
And I think, you know, I personally prefer that, you know, cozy, intimate. Also, like I said, the fact that it was 1974, trapped in the middle, you know, you're in this house in the middle of nowhere. You know, everything was, you know, it just really... It just works. Mm-hmm. Romance aside, it just works. And you know, again, next week, I think we'll see that again. And I'm long may that continue.
I think this kind of ties into what you guys have both been saying, especially about the episode being like very intimate. The whole episode feels a lot, almost to me, like an old Hammer film. With the dark lighting and very, you know, dreary sort of setup and everything like that. A very enclosed space with a I think intimate is a good word. Intimate cast of characters. Doctor Who, it tries to appeal to the Star Wars crowd a little bit too often. Rings of Akaten was definitely one of those. And, you know, it had its interesting moments with the great set design and the great character design on all the monsters and aliens and whatnot walking around. But when it's just this and it's just, four people in a mansion trying to solve a mystery, that's when it's absolutely at its best. And here, what makes that even better is that the pacing was so measured throughout, and so it took its time to breathe. And we've said before that Stephen Moffat this isn't a Moffat written episode, but Moffat episodes in general under his direction are usually at their worst when he tries to get too breathless and he tries to shove in everything all at the same time, like the Wedding of River Song, when literally they try to just shove everything into one space all at the same time. And here they're not trying to do that. They have it to what is, in my mind, one of the best looking creatures that they've had in a while, and it's not completely wasted like it was in Rings of Akaten, with their weird sort of cancerous floop monster from Spy Kids, which is what I kept thinking it looked like.
And they never really show the Crooked Man up close. You see the back of his head, but that's essentially...
Not until the very, very end. Yeah. And that's another thing they did in Cold War. You don't see the Ice Warrior's actual face until the very, very end. Not clearly, anyway. They very much... Again, a very sort of horror movie kind of thing. There, you don't show me the monster until the very last moment. And I think that's absolutely great. And it shows some much better pacing than we've seen in certain Moffat episodes of late. You know, Angels Take Manhattan, I think, is the one is my go-to for a very poorly paced episode.
I think with Moffat that, I got nothing but respect for the guy, because obviously, you know, he's very committed to Doctor Who. But I think his best episodes were the ones he wrote when he wasn't the showrunner.
Yes.
And, you know, that's where you look at Silence in the Library. You look at Blink. That's a classic. And again, it's just, it's like the pressure's off and he's not thinking of an overarching theme for an entire season. And I mean, it started to go a little bit pear-shaped, especially with the use of River Song. You know, when his Angels episodes, like you said, Angels Take Manhattan. I mean, yeah, I got a little bit emotional at the end because obviously we're saying goodbye to two characters who'd been around for a while. But it just feels a little, like I said, he's trying to deliver that wow factor. And sometimes you don't have to put that much effort into creating that atmosphere and that wow. I mean, sometimes the simplest stuff is the stuff that lasts the longest.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's, Moffat to me feels a lot like sort of a J.J. Abrams, a British J.J. Abrams, where he has a brilliant idea, but is just not a man who can stretch that idea over the course of an entire story arc. He's a guy you want to bring in to do one episode or a two-parter episode and just have his idea exist in its own little pocket universe and then let that kind of sink in for everybody else. But don't tell him that he has to make those ideas pay off for a long time. That's something we've really been feeling, and especially in these last couple episodes of The Lonely TARDIS that we've been talking about, is Moffat just doesn't do payoff as well as he should be or could be. And it's been really sad to see, because he has such strong openings. The Silence, such a great villain that just went nowhere by the end of the previous season, and I'm really interested to see where he eventually takes things this time around, because it does seem like he's didn't quite know where to go with getting rid of Amy and Rory midway through, and then reintroducing Clara again when he did it. I'm worried that we're going to run out of time before he can work out his kinks, but we'll see.
And that was what
it'll be interesting to see come the end of this year. I mean, the rumor is Matt Smith is going to be off in the beginning of next year, which should bring us to the fall of the 11th, the Fields of Trenzalore, and that's where the Silence will fall. And so it'll be interesting to see if he'll... I think that's the ultimate acid test of Stephen Moffat's writing on how he handles the end of the Matt Smith era. Because I also think the end of the Matt Smith era will probably be the end of the Stephen Moffat era.
So that's that's one thing that I've been saying quite often. Actually, I've been hearing that drumbeat quite heavily over the last couple weeks, so to say. Moffat made the comments, I think it was a couple weeks ago, where he said that it's actually in the Entertainment Weekly magazine. He had an interview in there where he said, you know, working on Doctor Who often and as often as he has been essentially tiring him, in a nutshell, and that he's kind of leading on that he's getting, I don't want to say worn out with Doctor Who, but it's taken its toll on him. And obviously with Sherlock and other things that he has going on, that
you can tell his mind is elsewhere, especially with Sherlock. Yeah.
And now, and Doctor Who's become such a huge thing now in the U.S. as well as every outside of the U.K. that it may not be his focus. And so I started to think that this season, second half of this season, where he's begun reintroducing a lot of the classic Doctor Who elements, has been almost like a reset to where, hey, you know, we do have this huge history of Doctor Who. It wasn't, you know, Moffat trying to get away from. No longer trying to get away from what Doctor Who used to be and paving his own way, where now he's thinking, and this is my interpretation, but now he's saying, let's get back to where Doctor Who used to be so that we can hit the firm reset button and Matt Smith will be done, I can move on, and somebody else will take over.
Sort of like, let's close the loop.
Yeah, close the loop. But you can never tell with Moffat, but it certainly seems that way. It seems like he's towards the end of his tenure.
I think it's certainly our hope anyway that this is all just, I mean, I keep calling back to things we've already said on previous podcasts, but we've been saying for a long time that we keep hoping that Moffat is just playing the long game and that the reason that there hasn't been a lot of payoff with some of his ideas is that it's all going to eventually come together when he finally is ready to step down and it all comes together at the end of his full run rather than at the end of any individual season.
I hope it's not like Lost, where they kept dragging the show on until they finally knew when they were stopping.
Well, I think I don't think Doctor Who will ever be like Lost. I mean, that's the beauty of the way it works. You get you can regenerate the Doctor, the TARDIS, you can change up the companions, and you can change the writer. I think let's see what happens at the end of this series or this season rather in 3 weeks time, 4 weeks time. The name of the Doctor is one that's going to be very interesting.
Yes, yeah.
See, very important.
See how he handles River Song returning. And then, see what happens with the 50th, because, from October on, it's going to be, whootastic. there'll be so much stuff going on that hopefully he can lock up some things and, he can give us some final answers and not play this out over another season and a half. So, and he's not the only one who's been guilty of sort of like putting Doctor Who's past in the past and burying it. I mean, Russell T. Davis did that a lot. I mean,
more so than Moffat did, if you ask me.
Yeah, Russell T. Davis was obviously a guy who had a background in writing dramas and soap operas in the UK, and then that's what he's really good at is building those characters. That's why I think Donna was so good, and that's why we see the Doctor beyond the companions, beyond who they are. We saw their families, we saw Donna's family, we saw Wilf,
And, you know, sometimes that paid off, such as, like I said, like as it did with Donna's family. Sometimes it didn't with Martha and the annoying Joneses. but I think, you know, Moffat's had to move away from that. And, you know, he's trying to put his own stake in the ground for Doctor Who. But I think Mark Gatiss is the guy I would like to see take over. I think he is a long-time fan. He writes him. He knows Moffat's style as well. Mm-hmm. See, they write together on Sherlock. He has been a showrunner before when he did The League of Gentlemen, which was, so that's why some of his stuff has some really good dark humor in it. Anybody who has seen The League of Gentlemen or hasn't seen it, I recommend finding it. It's sick and twisted. It's a brilliant sketch show. Yeah, I really recommend seeing that. I mean, it's just you could see Doctor Who landing in the middle of this town, Royston Vasey, that they have in that show, and he would be totally bemused. But there's a lot of good stuff that Moffat has done. But yeah, I think it's coming to the stage where he needs to step back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have my only issue with Mark Gatiss is, I don't know how I feel about handing over Doctor Who to the guy who wrote The Idiot's Lantern and Night Terrors. Not two of my favorite episodes.
Well, again, I mean, you look at Idiot's Lantern, and that was part of the Russell T. Davis. Mm-hmm. And again, this is what, you know, you've got to understand that the way it works with Doctor Who is you have the showrunner, and, you know, he has his ideas for the season, and then the writers come in and pitch their ideas around that, and then he has final say to edit and change and everything. And again, The Idiot's Lantern was one of these ones that was, you know, and again, I think for me, it's probably something that I'm more familiar with, being a Brit and having gone through, mm-hmm. you know, Queen's Jubilees and that sort of stuff, where you sure. would sit around the TV. And, you know, that's what it was. I mean, the Idiot Box has been the nickname for the TV for the longest time in the UK.
Sure.
And so that's just, the way it is. So, I mean, for me, that felt like a really good episode, with a lot of potentially really good bits in there. The Wire was an interesting enemy. And again, it's a lot of character actors that as a Brit you've grown up watching. So I think that was probably more an homage and a throwback to, you know, the 30, 40, and 50-year-old Doctor Who fans, as opposed to perhaps the new Who fans from America.
As someone who once had to defend the political stuff in the revised Battlestar Galactica to a British person who didn't understand that it was tied to a lot of American politics at the time, I cannot disagree with anything you just said. By law, I am not allowed.
By law.
It's the same. I mean, look, that's why you look at some of the stuff that was put in at the end of time. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, Obama's going to fix everything, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it is this very, you know, it's a British show first and foremost. And it was a British show that, you know, picked up and has done really well in the US. So now the emphasis is to make it more of perhaps a global show. I mean, it is the biggest money spinner the BBC have. Mm-hmm. Merchandising, DVDs, it's licensed all over the world. It's, you know, it's right up there, makes more money for them than any of their other things. And it's built a custom designed and built filming village down in Cardiff Bay, right next to the Doctor Who Experience. Yeah, it's a vast village where they have so many great shows filmed now. And Doctor Who was paid for that.
I think when a show has its own variation on Disneyland just for one single TV show, yeah, I think that's pretty good indication that you've made it. So,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, Marcus, what are your thoughts on the 50th anniversary special? I guess you could say. I know you mentioned October onward. It's gonna be pretty amazing for Doctor Who fans. What exactly do you want to see out of the 50th? I mean, I'm assuming you already know that Tennant is a part of the. He's been seen, you know, he's filming with Matt Smith, and Tennant's TARDIS is there, and Rose is supposedly going to be in the episode. So,
I mean, happy to see Tennant back. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to, see, you know, I'm hoping that they manage to incorporate more than just Tennant, because again, this isn't just a celebration of New Who. I mean, this is a celebration of the entire thing, and we don't have Patrick Troughton or John Pertwee with us anymore, but we have Tom and Colin Baker, mm-hmm. we have Sylvester McCoy, we have Paul McGann, we have Peter Davidson, and I think that there is definitely some good, you know, it would be great to see some of the friction between some of those characters, you know, because some of the best Doctor Who team-ups have been when he's teamed up with himself. Mm-hmm. As for Rose, well, as far as I'm concerned, that's just a, let me see, what can I say about Rose coming back? there you go, I sense it myself. yeah, I'm not too fussed on that. But again, you know, Donna Noble, they kind of wrote it so that Donna can't really come back. But I think, yeah, it's going to be some great stuff. I really hope we get to see some really good things coming back. You know, enemies, doctors, past companions. And, yeah, I mean, just celebrate where the show has been and what it's done and what it's meant to a whole country. I mean, it's right up there with James Bond. Mm-hmm. And I say this a lot. James Bond and Doctor Who are quintessential parts of British DNA. Because, you know, they are through tough times, through thick and thin, you know, the Beatles are out there and, you know, they've done their thing as well, but nothing has endured in pop culture more than Doctor Who and James Bond both celebrating their 50th anniversaries. I mean, you know, the fact that they're still relevant today is just outstanding. And I mean, people, you know, people bring up Battlestar Galactica and I laugh. I laugh at them for bringing it. It was a great reboot for the first season, and then it bent over, saw its own ass, and crawled up it for the next 3 years. So yeah, I mean, I'm exceptionally proud to be British and be a fan of Who, and I think, like I said, this 50th anniversary, I hope they do it right. I hope they do it. You know, we get more episodes you can shake a stick at. We get more specials. We get everything that we want, and we get a true celebration and not BBC doing it on the cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, next week we get the episode titled Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, which is going to feature the heart of the TARDIS, obviously, and Clara. The quick summary they posted was Clara essentially gets lost in the center of the TARDIS. The promo pics that have been posted, and have you seen these yet, gentlemen,
I have looked at them.
Fair warning, not necessarily spoilers, but the final promotional image that they've shown has a book lying on a table that's titled, frankly, it's, you know, in bold letters, The History of the Time War. So I'm really interested to see what this next episode is going to be about, because it's starting to dive into some of the big questions that I've had about Doctor Who over the last few years, just since the Davis and Moffat have taken over. So we'll find out more, obviously, this coming weekend about Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. I'm pretty excited. I'm hopeful you guys are as well.
The answer to the only question that matters that will be answered in this next episode is how long we have to wait until the second Doctor Who TV movie starring Paul McGann fighting in the Time War, when that airs. That's the answer that I'm waiting for.
Well, we don't know if Paul McGann did fight in the Time War.
That's right.
Unless you go by some of the Big Finish stuff, the audio stuff, the audio plays.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that to me, I I'm one of these people that if it isn't captured on film, it doesn't exist.
Yeah. It's not canon.
But I mean, it would be interesting for the 50th to see if they can do something with the Time War. And this is, you know, building up to it. And as excited as I am about seeing the TARDIS swimming pool next week, they're saying you finally get to see the swimming pool. If my knowledge of the schedule is on point, the week after we get to see the Neil Gaiman.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
And that's the return of the Cybermen. And it's the return of the Cybermen from Mondas, not the parallel, guys who are basically just, you know, crap. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the original Cybermen from Mondas. That's, and the fact that Neil Gaiman, who again wrote another brilliant episode in, The Doctor's Wife.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was such a great.
And this is getting off topic of the next episode, but yeah, I am a tremendous Neil Gaiman fan, and seeing him take on such a non-Neil Gaiman-y type villain, this very physical and sort of large-scale kind of enemy with the Cybermen sounds so interesting to me. And yeah, he did do one of the best episodes of last season, one of the best episodes of the Moffat run, in my opinion, in The Doctor's Wife.
definitely. Yeah, sorry, and like I said, I didn't want to divert away from, you know, the Heart of the TARDIS, but I think the Heart of the TARDIS is definitely going to set up set something up for you know, maybe even the series for the season finale this year, and you know, and for next year. I mean, just that last spoiler image is, you know, I could have done without seeing that, to be honest with you. They could have not released that. And that is the one thing that I hate about social media nowadays. Yes, everything's instantly accessible, but I'm so sick of, you know, people posting pictures and everybody feeling the need to post 100,000 pictures. And it's like when I play a game, I don't want people to tell me the story in advance. I don't want people to give away cool little things. I mean, I love it when I discover shit for myself. And sorry, I swore.
No, we swear quite a bit.
Yeah, you don't want it to be BioShock Infinited.
Yeah, I haven't completed that, gentlemen. Please don't.
I'll dally at the end of the game.
It was all a dream. The episode that Neil Gaiman wrote is called Nightmare in Silver. So that one's going to be... Yeah.
It's a great title. It sounds like a Batman the Animated Series episode name. I love it.
I really hope he comes back and writes an episode a year. He's done... obviously the Doctor's Wife was fantastic, so I'm hopeful that that he continues and becomes
he is the new Stephen Moffat.
He is the new Stephen Moffat. Oh, what if Neil Gaiman took over Doctor
Stephen
Who?
Moffat.
Anyway, so we do have a couple quick little comments from a couple of our listeners here. I asked on social media. Sorry to get back to social media. I said, or your thoughts, and Keith Dotson noted that he absolutely loved this week's episode because it was much improved over last week, and he felt that the ghost aspect was executed really well. And obviously we know there never really is a ghost in Doctor Who lore. It always seems to be some type of manifestation of the physics that we know of in the show, or seems sometimes created on the fly. So
I'm surprised they didn't mention the Gelf at all at any point in this one. Or the Gelf, or am I pronouncing that right? I forget already.
The Geth.
Geth. Geth.
It was just straight up the Geth.
I was going to say that wasn't the mansion outside of Cardiff, so it's not on the Rift.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Okay. I thought, you know, the Geth had to be wrong because that was
Mass Effect. Navin Reddy says he thought it was much better than last week. It still wasn't great. He said it had some good scare moments, and he liked the smaller cast, but he's still unsatisfied with the direction that the season has taken. So I guess we're seeing both sides of the coin. We hear these comments a lot, and we can only hope that there are some of these big episodes coming up here, obviously this coming weekend and next week's Neil Gaiman's episode that really energize the fans. So with that said, we every week do a rating of what we felt of the episode we just watched. I think this week we'll use best of five.
Daniel Radcliffe's.
Daniel Radcliffe's. Best of five ghosts. So out of... Marcus, you get to go first. Out of five ghosts, what would you rate this episode?
In context of the season so far, I would give it a four.
Okay, four out of five. Steven, how about yourself?
Man, if I was rating this in a vacuum compared to this half of the season, just this half of the season, this would be a five. But knowing what I know about loving Doctor Who as much as I have in the past, I got to give it a four. I think it's the strongest episode this season. I just don't. I've been burned so much by this season so far. I need a real high to really bring me back around.
I'm also going to give it a four spooky ghosts out of five. I just love the return to the horror aspects, and it seemed like every scene in the episode seemed to have something really interesting going on and something behind it. And I hadn't seen that in Doctor Who in a long time. At least this season executed this well. So everything was tense. So I gave it a 4 out of 5. And Sean also gave it a 4 out of 5. He liked it throughout, except for the last 5 or 10 minutes.
based on his DMs to me, that's higher than I thought he was going to get.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. He actually didn't give me a number, so I'm completely paraphrasing what he told me. So whether he likes the 4 out of 5 or not, it's what I'm, giving.
Sean's comments were very similar to mine, so if I give it a 4, he can give it a 4.
There you go, most definitely. With that said, we're going to shut the show down. But Marcus, where can people find you if they're looking for you?
Well, they can find me on the Twitter, as the young people like to do. I am at Annoyed Gamer, and I do have the coolest Twitter avatar. It's basically somebody sketched me loitering outside a TARDIS with a pint of beer in my hand. that was my good friend Johnny Fournier who did that. And then if you go to Game Trailers, I have a show on there called Annoyed Gamer where I rant about video games and use very strong language.
Perfect, perfect. And you're also on Invisible Walls and seen you on Weekend Confirm and kind of floating all over the place. So you are a man of you are nomadic at some times. Yeah.
Whore, you mean I am a whore?
You're a whore.
The opening of an envelope.
Steven, where can we find you?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Steven Strom. That's StevenStrom. You can find me at DND Podcast, which is .com, which is another podcast that I do, and you can also find me on Real SQTV on YouTube.
Yep, you do the video portion of our wonderful, wonderful website. You can find me as usual at Cool Rats, KewlRats. Until I find a better name, I've had that stupid screen name for about 12 to 15 years now. I need to have something new. And you can find Sean Norton, obviously, at Sean Norton, SHAUNNORTON. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at Lonely TARDIS. You can find us on iTunes if you do a search. Please rate and review us. We really appreciate it. It helps us get to the very top of Doctor Who podcasts, and entertainment podcasts, and fun podcasts in general.
We have to break the Doctor Who podcast over at that other side questing ripoff site.
Yeah, exactly.
I forgot the name.
And with that said, thank you, everybody. We will see you next time on The Lonely TARDIS. Thank you so much. Goodbye.